great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And today, to start the show, we're going to be talking about the relationship between pests and crops. And we're going to do that with the leader of a UW-Madison lab that studies just that. Russ Groves supervises students and staff in the Wisconsin Vegetable Crop Entomology Lab. It's based out of UW-Madison. He's an insect ecologist, a vegetable crop specialist, and he chairs the Department of Entomology. And we're going to talk with him about insect resistance, talk about viruses transmitted through pests to plants, and a whole lot more. And, of course, we'd love to have you join the conversation. What questions do you have about crops and pests? Maybe you're a farmer. Maybe you're an organic farmer. What's your experience? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email, the email address ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Russ, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Larry, thank you. And thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you and to visit with your audience today. It's really a great opportunity.
First time you and I have talked together. It's hard to believe you've been around and doing some work for a long time. You've studied crops and specialty crops for decades. Can you remind listeners about the economic impact of those crops in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. Especially for your longtime listeners, people probably remember that many cities or towns in Wisconsin, maybe that were above, say, 5,000 or 6,000, used to have a cannery in those towns. They don't usually maybe have those canneries any longer, but that was really evidence of the fact that of Wisconsin's processing history. Wisconsin has historically been and continues to be a leader in processing vegetable production, the middle of the grocery store or in the freezer section. With respect to vegetables, is where you'll find produce that's grown in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Thinking back as you were talking there, remembering my days as a youth and driving a viner, a pea viner, near Sun Prairie, it was quite an experience, long hours to do that. As we look at pests, how much damage do pests do to crops in the state every year?
Well, it can certainly be very significant. I mean, part of the reason that the industry started here in the upper Midwest and in Wisconsin and southern Minnesota to give credit, and also northern Illinois to give further credit, has to do with winter. And so that winter time was sort of a biological reset for insects and diseases that we don't have in other production areas of the country, like California or the winter garden area of Texas or Florida, where continuous production means almost continuous, you know, potential for damage or risk. So, we compared to the rest of the country, we're a little bit, I would say, below average in that potential, again, because of the winter reset period. But make no mistake, there are definitely perennial pests that we find across our processing crops that can cause us, you know, real significant economic loss. And, you know, some that are really noteworthy that are perennial pests are some of the ear pests that we see in sweet corn, or some of the, you know, like the potato beetles that we see on potatoes as examples. These are ones just as a rule from year to year that we'll always see and can cause us significant loss.
And when we look at managing these pests, maybe it'd be worth it, I think, to talk about how farmers manage them now.
Yeah. Well, that management is sort of a dynamic process. Producers have always been trying to innovate and try to take the best road, if you will, or make the best choice as far as management. And of course, it varies based on the producer. As you mentioned, Larry, we have a wide scale of production for vegetables in Wisconsin. We have some very large scale producers that produce for our commercial canners and packers. We have some mid-scale producers that are truck farmers that are producing for local markets, et cetera, or specialty restaurants. And then we have all sorts of scale in terms of we have organics, as well as reduced risk or conventional management. So everybody that comes to management can kind of go about it a little bit differently. But everyone is, I would say, in the state of Wisconsin, always trying to innovate and improve in the way that they're doing that.
Yeah. Well, your lab, it's the Wisconsin Vegetable Crop Entomology Lab. And by the way, we have a link to it on our website. So as you listen, you could take a look at it at WPR.org/Larry. You study insect resistance. And how common is it for insects to be resistant to insecticides?
Yeah, that's unfortunately one of the outcomes of our pest management. We do our best, maybe relative to your prior question, we do our best to integrate as many different tools as we can together to try and manage a pest. We try to anticipate when they're going to be there. We try to look for resources that are available actually through, for example, our Wisconsin Vegetable Newsletter or from the Department of Agriculture, which puts out a nice set of references that give people an advance notification of when pests might be arriving, using a variety of different, cultural, physical, mechanical tools before we necessarily ever have to use a pesticide. But in the event that we do have to use a pesticide, we always have to be careful because if you stress an insect population too frequently with the same kind of stress or pesticide, Mother Nature has a way of adapting to that stress. And of course, the adaptation that we call that is resistance, because what we're seeing, the observation is, oh boy, look, those insects have become resistant, to this tool. And it's commonplace in a variety of insects, but certainly not all of them. And that's probably based on differences in their life history strategy.
And, you look at the business of insecticide resistance. There's a new technology. It's called RNA interference pesticides, or RNAi, I guess is the short way to say it. And that's being developed. Maybe you could talk about those RNAi pesticides.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Lots of new technologies coming along. A lot of these, to be honest, have been innovated and are being developed in human health situations, to be quite honest, probably more rapidly than they are even in agriculture. So you mentioned RNA interference, which we shorten to RNAi. But, probably many of your listeners have also heard of technologies like CRISPR. And this is a gene editing approach. But the point here is in both of these situations, and today we'll speak more to RNAi, it's really just taking advantage of some of the innate processes that are inside, in this case, insects. And by exploiting those processes that go on, we can actually sort of make an insect kill itself, so to speak. Or in the case of some of our work, we can actually turn a resistant individual or a population into a susceptible population. And so we do that by exploiting an internal mechanism in the insect, actually in us as well, that is the normal process that shuts down the production of a protein. If you'll remember your biochemistry 101,
long time ago.
and I don't think my biochemistry colleagues would let me get away with saying a 101. It's probably a 500 level, biochemistry course. But remember when a eukaryote, which we are eukaryotes, insects are eukaryotes, when we need to produce a protein, that happens when single-stranded RNA leaves the nucleus and then is transcribed in the cell. And then as part of the normal process of downregulating that message, over time, many of those single-stranded RNAs will come together into a double-stranded form. And that is the cell's signal to then go in and process those up and actually go hunt for those single-stranded molecules and put a, what we call a methyl group, a CH3, a methyl group on there, which effectively silences that production. So if you're following, what we've done is we've tried to learn what genes are involved in resistance, or we've tried to learn what genes are critical for an insect. And if we can actually deliver small elements that are of those analogous to those genes in the form of double-stranded RNA, and if we deliver them in the cells of the insects don't know anything more to do with that than to silence those same genes in the insect. So if we know what genes are critical, we can formulate double-stranded versions of those, double-stranded RNA versions, introduce them to the insects, effectively feed it to them, and it'll the insects will themselves shut their own genes down. This is RNA interference. So you can target a critical gene for life if you choose, or you could, in the case of our lab, you can target the genes that are encoding resistance.
So in your research, does that lead to the death of the insect then, or what?
In our case, no. So for example, remember, an insect that is continues to receive, let's say, you know, too much of the same, you know, compound that over successive generations or successive years, it develops resistance. And then you might ask the question, okay, what is the actual mechanism of that resistance? What we're finding, for example, in the insects that we study, the Colorado potato beetle, there are a couple of main genes that we see across populations in Wisconsin, a couple of main genes that are actually involved in metabolic detoxification. And this is the actual enzyme complex that's in the insect that helps it deal with the plant on which it lives, potato. Nobody likes eating potato leaves, do they?
No, you wouldn't want to.
You wouldn't want to. It'd give you a bellyache. We've learned that these same detoxification genes are the ones that it looks like the insects are using to detoxify the insecticides. So if we know what gene it is and we deliver a small segment in a double-stranded form that's analogous to that detoxification gene, what does it do? It shuts down the ability of the insect to detoxify the insecticide. So they become susceptible again. Now, make no mistake, there are companies that are working on going after genes that are critical, you know, important for the life of that insect. And yes, if you shut those down, it can be lethal.
Our guest today, Russell Groves, he supervises students and staff in the Wisconsin Vegetable Crop Entomology Lab. It's based at UW-Madison. He's a professor and chairs the Department of Entomology. Great to have him with us today. Questions for him as we talk about this relationship between crops and pests. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Mackenzie Crummy, our producer today. Tyler Ditter is our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Professor Russell Groves from the Department of Entomology. He is chairperson of the department, as a matter of fact, and also supervises students and staff in the Wisconsin Vegetable Crop Entomology Laboratory. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. Again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Ross in Middleton, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. So the question I have is it, can this technology where you're doing some genetic manipulation, we'll call it, of these insects, I'd learned that in Wisconsin and I think some of our eastern forests, that the hemlock tree is under severe duress, that it might, we might lose that our hemlock trees because of an insect that came from, I can't remember. And then also, I guess we could just think of it like the emerald ash borer. Can this technology, does he see it realistically, sort of in the nearest future, where they can turn off some of these insects that are ruining our forests?
Yeah.
Well, it's go ahead, Larry.
No, I was going to say, go, tell you to go ahead, Russ.
Okay. Thank you. No, it's a great question. And the answer is sort of a tentative or a pensive yes. I'll say this, and that is some of the technicality is actually delivering, you know, these basically double-stranded RNAs to the insect. And many insects have the ability to just eat it. And to be honest, then that double-stranded RNA will move across the lining of the gut into the bloodstream of the insect. And once in the bloodstream, those small molecules, those small RNAs will move into the cells and actually, you know, have the effect of like killing the insect. So in the case, I'm just going to guess, I think maybe you're thinking about an insect called an adelgid, which is an aphid that is really affecting hemlock. We see that in a couple of different species, like with mountain pine beetle out west, and we see it kind of linking to this, you know, issue with climate change. We see forest systems that are undergoing stresses due to, you know, changing climate. And then what it does is it predisposes them, you know, to these insect infestations like the aphid in hemlock or, you know, the pine beetles, you know, in western forests. So I guess I might say there, the only challenge is being able to get them to eat it. So, and in this case, you know, applying it in forest systems is a challenge because you have to apply it over large expansive areas, just like you do pesticides, but you have to get it in those places where the insects are feeding. And in the case of the adelgid, that might be a little bit more of a possibility. With bark beetles, as you might know, they bore right into the stem, so they might be able to bypass, you know, our ability to deliver it, you know, and spray. So this is certainly not an approach or a material that's a cure-all for every insect, and getting it to the insect and actually getting it into their bodies, just the logistical challenges there are certainly real.
Yeah, but I'm betting there are people that are working on that research, Russ.
Oh, absolutely, Larry. And it's amazing. People are doing things like packaging them in, you know, like what we call nanoparticle delivery systems, and trying to be able to get them, you know, into plants. So for things like boring insects, you know, that they might encounter it in that way, if we can deliver it, you know, into the plant that way, or thinking about baits, incorporating it into a bait where there might be what we call an attract and kill, you know, kind of a phenomenon. If you know what sort of attracts the, you know, the insects, but to do that on the scale that our caller mentioned, especially in forest systems, those are challenging systems.
Ross, great question. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Paul in Eau Claire. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Two quick comments. I really enjoy your show, and I love the way that Dr. Groves is able to really explain the technology and how it applies to practical applications. So, thanks. My other comment is when people don't know the difference between entomology and etymology, does that bug you?
No pun there, right, Paul? No, it doesn't quite bug us. In fact, our dean's office tells us, you know, hey, you guys got to get into the, you know, the the next century. No, I mean, it's just, you're right. Sometimes it's a misunderstanding. We need to make sure that people understand entomology is insect science. And so kind of the idea of branding ourselves and rebranding ourselves and making ourselves as visible and so that the public can understand us. So maybe it's just a pronunciation thing too, right? Maybe I just need to be able to say entomology.
How many folks do you have in your lab working on this RNAi business, by the way?
Well, we had one student and one postdoc that was working on it over the last several years. Right now, a lot of what we're doing, most of our staff scientists are continuing projects. We have a couple of different relationships with the biotech companies or biotechnology companies who have developed their own approaches. And we do some research with them to demonstrate and better understand, you know, how we can increase the efficiency of these tools. I think in the case of, for example, when McKinsey reached out to me, she was reading an article where I was, you know, where a journalist was quoting me in a piece with respect to one of our company associates called Greenlight Biosciences, and they are out of the Boston area. And they're developing a double-stranded RNA that can be sprayed onto potato, and then the potato beetle eats it, and it effectively knocks out a critical gene in the potato beetle. And it's a lethal phenotype. I mean, the insect dies. Actually, it's really kind of interesting. What they're knocking out is an enzyme that tells the beetle that it's hungry or unsatiated. So if you knock it out, then the beetle thinks that it's full. And so the beetle doesn't eat. And so the result is, it's kind of an interesting, tricky outcome, right? You just tell the insect it doesn't need to eat. And, you know, an insect not eating for 4 or 5 days, it basically desiccates or dies. So we're working with a group like that. It's interesting, the target that they're going after. And then we have done some work with in the past with, you know, the group originally out of St. Louis, Monsanto, which is now Bayer Crop Science. They have some tools of their own that they're working towards. And we've done some partnerships there. Again, their phenotype was a lethal phenotype. Yeah.
Let's take another call. Tom in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I hear about the decline of the insect population throughout the world, and I'm wondering what are the risks to this procedure of controlling insects, even if it's for beneficial for humans. What about the total insect population?
Yeah, another good question. Russ?
Yeah, no, that's great. You're right. There's been some really seminal publications in the last 4 to 5 years just talking about losses in you know, insect biomass and biodiversity. And to be quite honest, these are alarming papers and outcomes to read about. And so then the question is, you know, how does a technology like this, you know, potentially continue to contribute to something like that? Well, let's think about that for a minute. If you developed a piece of double-stranded RNA that would target a critical gene that was present in every insect, oh my goodness, that would be horrible.
That would be awful.
That would be a horrible idea. And to be quite honest, our EPA would not authorize something like that. In the case of what's being developed now, part of the reason why, in my opinion, this technology will become really valuable is that with a lot of this DNA sequencing data that's available, you know, to the public, people now can query these genomic resources, things that are published, And you can find genes and the appropriate segment of genes that will result in a lethal phenotype, but is specific only to that one taxa. So in the case of, like, for example, the group that I mentioned in Boston, based on sequence data, the small RNA, the small double-stranded RNA that they're delivering will only have an effect on Colorado potato beetle. And I consider that to be, you know, a valuable, you know, aspect. So I might suggest that so long as we develop the right gene targets to knock out, you know, we'll be making, I think, valuable improvements over the unfortunate history of using broad spectrum materials, which have potentially contributed to this, you know, lowering of insect numbers and declines in biodiversity.
Yeah. Tom, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join in. The number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Ben emailed and is wondering if you could talk about diatomaceous earth, that, you know, a fine rock powder that scratches the surface of insects, dehydrates them essentially, and kills them. Ben says, hey, it's non-toxic, no resistance is possible. It's inexpensive, he says, and you can apply it when insects are present. And certainly that can work, I would guess, I'm sure it can work in at least in smaller sized operations. But what about that, Ross?
Yeah. Oh, no, it's a totally viable tool. It's one of those tools that right now is mostly in the sort of the home garden or the smaller scale market segment. Unfortunately doesn't receive as much use on sort of the larger scale of agriculture. And I would say part of that reason is it's kind of dependent upon the organism that you're going after. If you're going after a soft-bodied caterpillar, for example, like a cutworm that is on the soil, you know, over winter, hangs out during the day at the soil line and then migrates up the plants, you know, in the evening. It's a kind of a nocturnal feeder. And those soft-bodied insects that interact with diatomaceous earth, you know, on the soil, you know, going in and out, it's absolutely, you know, a great tool. Make no mistake. But there's also a lot of adult insects that have hardened, you know, exoskeletons. The diatomaceous earth doesn't, you know, really work. So it's kind of dependent upon, you know, what you're going after and the circumstances and the situation. But it is an absolutely, you know, appropriate tool. It's a tool in the toolkit. There's no question.
Let's take another call. Vicki in Appleton will turn to you now. Hi, Vicki. Thank you for calling.
Hi. And to backtrack some, the words entomology and etymology have always really puzzled. I get tripped up over them, and I always back up and think, okay, ant. The word ant is in there. It may not really be, but anyway, it sounds like ants. So, entomology is, I figure, bugs, and etymology is words.
Yes, absolutely. And there's definitely an ant in there somewhere. I don't think it's in the spelling quite, but there's definitely an ant in the entomology for sure.
Vicki, thank you. That's a good way to remember it. Oh my goodness. You know, there we talked about one of the concerns that an earlier caller mentioned, you know, is it possible that we could just be eliminating all the insects? You talked about that. Are there other kinds of concerns that you've thought about or that have come up in the course of your work?
Well, I mean, we were talking about resistance, and we were talking about how, you know, we are trying to deliver you know, these kind of tools to knock down, you know, an insect's ability to, you know, resist traditional insecticides or pesticides. But make no mistake, I mean, again, my shout out to Mother Nature. These are not silver bullets. These tools are not silver bullets. And several people have published in the last 4 to 5 years that you can actually generate resistance even to these targets. So they're not going to be, they're certainly not going to be sort of the end all be all, but they are going to be what I hope, you know, is a very safe and specific set of tools that in my estimation really help us make, you know, significant improvements over, you know, traditional pesticides, traditional broad spectrum pesticides.
Somebody else was wondering, the Colorado potato beetle, why should we be zeroing in on it, for example, for these RNAi pesticides?
It's a really good question, and maybe your caller has a little bit of familiarity, but potato beetles are in a group called Chrysomelids. That's the family name. And it just so happens that the early work on feeding double-stranded RNA to insects, these Chrysomelids, which again, potato beetle is one of these, they have a set of membrane proteins that are in the gut lining that very easily transport these double-stranded RNAs across. And they move it into the bloodstream of the insect with high efficiency. And so the effect is very obvious. Not all insects have those same proteins. So it's not as if we can choose Colorado potato beetle because it's an agronomically or, you know, important pest, no question. But part of the reason that we focused on it is because it has some of the innate capacity to be able to allow this technology to move. Not all insects have this. And so, because the caller might say, why aren't you focusing on an insect that is, you know, equally a challenge, like corn earworm? You know, that's something in the tip of our sweet corn, you know, all the time. And those caterpillars don't have those same membrane proteins, or at least we haven't figured out which ones they are. So part of the reason we're going after Colorado potato beetle is because it's easy and other people have paved the way for that.
You know, the lab also researches how insects transmit pathogens to plants. And that's kind of a fascinating thing in and of itself, how that all happens.
Yeah. Well, just like, you know, insects that transmit diseases to you and I, you know, mosquitoes, ticks, for example, here in Wisconsin, you know, my colleague in the department, Susan Paskowitz, you know, works on these kinds of questions in man and animals. But a lot of insects will, you know, transmit diseases to crop plants. And this has been a part of our program, for as long as I've been at UW. There are some, in our seed potato industry, we grow probably 8 to 9,000 acres of seed potatoes up in Langlade County. And some of the biggest issues that they face in generating a disease-free seed crop is trying to limit the transmission by aphids of a virus that's called potato virus Y, the letter Y. And we truncate that to PVY. And don't ask why. It's just why. But anyway, and in some of our in our group, we've been trying to better understand like when aphids are present in the field and when they're flying in fields. And so with that knowledge, we can try to focus actually some what we consider to be very reduced risk approaches to try and limit the transmission by insects of this virus. So that's just one example of one insect and one virus, you know, combination that we work on.
Somebody else was wondering how long before the RNAi pesticides will become available to farmers to use.
Well, interesting enough, There's one right now. There's one that is part of the package of hybrid corn. The actual double-stranded RNA is being produced by the plant. So when it's being produced by the plant, in other words, the plant is synthesizing these double-stranded RNAs, then that's a genetic modification. And we can use genetic modifications to produce these double-stranded RNAs in the plant. That's not what we've been talking about. We've been talking about just spraying them, right? Just spraying them on the outside. So these are not genetic modifications. But there's a set of what we call ProStax corn right now that has an RNA in it, or an RNAi component in it, targeting rootworm. And coincidentally, rootworm beetles are chrysomelids. They're easy to get this phenomenon to work in. So the rootworm beetles feeding on roots below ground that are producing these double-stranded RNAs, this effect is taking place. I'm trying to recall, I'm going to say that ProStax, those ProStax hybrids have been out for a couple of years. And my understanding is they're performing well. In potatoes, the sprayable formulation that the group in Boston is working on is anticipated to be registered next year. So there will be a product that will be available, again, targeting potato beetles as early as next year.
Fascinating stuff, Russ. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us and talking about this work and this relationship between crops and pests. It's been wonderful, and I hope we can meet again and do this again. Thank you.
Yes, Larry. Thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity to interact with your audience.
Russell Groves supervises students and staff in the Wisconsin Vegetable Crop Entomology Lab. And if you want to take a look at what's online versus with his lab, we have a link to our website at WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date, and you'll get a link to that lab. It was fun talking with Russ, and we'll have him back, and we'll do it again. Going to turn our attention to something else, solar energy. Does your community have a solar energy project? We're going to be talking about solar in 2022 with our next guest, Nick Hyla. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.